I read an article this week that described the lack of progress in creative thinking. Critical thinking. Sorry, thinking creation. That's not right. So the lack of progress in critical thinking across college students 4 years, or five, or six, or seven, however many it ends up being. And so I don't know about you, but when I read what colleges have to say to promote, you know, why students should want to come there, they're lifting up the caliber of the students coming in. So it's, this many high school valedictorians and, you know, this SAT score average or that ACT score average. But they don't say, you know, once we get them, we don't really help them with their critical thinking, problem-solving skills. I haven't seen that promotion just yet. And, you know, they didn't just make this up. There's an instrument, a test, which is less well-known than the ACT or SAT, which measures critical thinking skills of incoming freshmen and then those who exit. And they're not all bad. I mean, there are some schools that are really attentive to that, and there's improvement. But for the most part, it's pretty flat, and in some cases even declines. And I'm thinking, those are probably the kids who never go to class. You know. But anyway, so why is critical, or what is it that goes into critical thinking or problem solving? First of all, there's attentiveness. You got to pay attention to what's going on in the world around you. Second thing is, and I think this is probably the key element, and it's a framework or a lens through which we view reality and interpret things. And then the third piece is discernment of some kind, some assessment of what is true, what is good, what is life-giving. And as I read this and I thought about it, the Christian faith or discipleship or following the way of Jesus is a lens. It's a framework. It's a way of viewing and understanding reality. It's a way of thinking critically about the world around us. And we would say that growth in that faith would be measured by an increase in the coherence between what we say and what we actually do, what we say we believe and how we actually live. And at Atonement, we have this thing called the faith journey, which describes growth in spiritual maturity from one saying, you know, I'm interested in learning more about Jesus, to I want to follow him, to I want to be close to him, to I want to love like him, or I do love like Jesus. That's progress, growth in on this journey. And we also have a way of measuring this statistically and interpreting it. All right. Well, the idea of measuring spiritual growth is not new to our time and our place. It was an issue for Martin Luther, and you know, just within the last 500 years, I mean, way, way back, nearly 500 years ago. And Luther was curious about the spiritual condition of the people around him, and so he undertook not a survey that was computer-generated and scored, but he did it the old-fashioned way. He went out and visited congregations and the people who were in them. And he found that they didn't really, that their critical thinking, at least through the lens of faith, was severely compromised. And Luther, if you didn't know this, you're going to know it after this morning, he had kind of an earthy way of saying things. So I'm going to share this with you directly because it's better than my summary. So this is what he found when he went out and looked around. Good God, what wretchedness I beheld. Isn't that beautiful? The common people, especially those who live in the country, have no knowledge. I thought that was a little bit classist, but we'll let it go. All right. Have no knowledge whatever of Christian teaching. And unfortunately, many pastors are quite incompetent and unfitted for teaching. Oh, well. Although the people are supposed to be Christian, are baptized, and receive the Holy Sacrament, they do not know the Lord's Prayer, the Creed, or the Ten Commandments. And big kick finish now. They live as if they were pigs and irrational beasts. And now that the gospel has been restored, they have mastered the fine art of abusing liberty. I've been here over 18 years. I've never given y'all a beatdown like that. My goodness. So Luther wasn't content to just let that go. He undertook to do something about it, and the way he did it was to write what we now know as the Small Catechism. So he had 2.5 months of visits, late 1528, early 1529. By May of 1529, we had the Small Catechism, which we still use as a teaching device in our confirmation classes, and which we're going to be using here for the next 11 weeks in our Sunday services. So 3 weeks on the Apostles' Creed, 4 weeks on the sacraments, followed by 4 weeks on the Lord's Prayer. And I think our challenge is to come up with a salty Lutheran quote for every one of those weeks. Luther goes on in the Large Catechism, which is what he writes for pastors. So the Small Catechism was meant to be taught by families in the home, and the Large Catechism goes into a little more depth, but covers the same material. That was meant for those incompetent pastors. And he goes on and he says there that the Creed teaches us everything that we need to know about God. He says also, by following the teachings of the Creed, we're able to live out the Ten Commandments. And he said in the Large Catechism that the Creed gives some substance to the answer that we might give when someone says, "What kind of God do you have?" So we go on and answer. So today we're not taking on the whole Creed. We're just taking on the first article. I believe in God the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. 12 words, that's all it is. There's a whole lot packed into those 12 words, and we're not going to unpack exhaustively this morning, but there are four ideas in there that are worth some pause and reflection. And the first is this, that it's God who creates. God creates. And not just some philosophical construct, remote, removed idea of a deity, but the God who Jesus calls Father and invites us to do the same. So that God creates everything. So there's not one creator for some things and another creator for other things, as ill-advised as I think mosquitoes are. There's one God who creates everything. And the Nicene Creed, which is one of the longer ones, it's not the longest, but it's longer than the Apostles' Creed, goes on to say of all that is seen and unseen, created by God. And it was not created in a random sequence. It wasn't like, okay, here are the raw materials. Now, let's see if we can get a cake out of them. There's an order. There's a design. There's an intention to creation. And the Bible describes this in many different ways. So sometimes we think, well, creation, you know, there's the Genesis story and that's it. Well, there are two creation stories in Genesis. We heard much of one of them today. And then we heard a creation story from John chapter 1. The Psalms are full of creation accounts, Isaiah, Job. The Bible has many, many, many accounts of creation. They describe the sequence, the order, differently, but one place where they're absolutely in agreement is that it is ordered and that it's God who does it. And part of that order is that God doesn't simply create and then step away. God remains involved in creation. That's part of the design. I have a number of friends who are involved in home building. And one, when he was first starting out, a field salesman, sold a home to a woman where the garage did not fit her car if she were to pull in nose first. Now, you know this was a long time ago, right? Because now we've got garages for, our stuff. But back then, it was a one-car garage because people only had one car, and this particular garage was too small for this particular car to pull in nose first. And he was going to lose the deal over this. But he observed that the car would fit in the garage if it were backed in. I don't know. I don't understand the physics of that, but it's his story. So now she says, well, I can't back the car in. I don't know how to do that. And he, being an enterprising guy who really wanted to win that month's sales contest, said, I will come to your house every day and back the car in at night. Which he did. As long as he worked for that company, he backed that car into her garage every night. And that's what came to mind as I was thinking about how God remains active and involved in our lives, not just, here it is, y'all figure it out. Okay. Active and involved. God provides for us in a sustaining way. Our health, our well-being, our homes, our food, our shelter. Luther even says part of what God provides is good government. Good government. All in this provision, how God remains involved. Well, what about us? We're very clear that God creates. We might be creative people, but we don't create. But we're also not passive. We have very important roles to play within God's creative process. And there were two terms that Julie read that I want to spend just a little bit of time on. One is God's image. That's one term, God's image. And that's not like, what a publicist might want to put forward. And the second is dominion. We're going to talk about God's image and dominion. Scholars aren't in 100% agreement about what God's image means, but it includes these things. There's something of God within humanity that is more than of God, more than what is of God in other created things, even living things. So there's a higher level of God-likeness in humanity. And it could have something to do with our capacity for learning and reason and wisdom and empathy and reflection, those kinds of things. But there's also a relational capacity within humans. Now, there are other animals that are social, but not to the depth of capacity that we have, not just to relate to each other, but to God, to know and be known by God. There's more of that in humanity than anywhere else. And so we say that humans, or the Bible says that humans are created in God's image. And in this account, I don't know if you noticed, but male and female God created them. Male and female God created them, and both are God's image-bearing creatures. And this word dominion. Dominion, sometimes there are words that when we hear them, they sound like other words and we think that's what they mean. So what's another word that sounds very close to dominion? Dominate, domination. Thank you. Thank you. So the difference between dominion and domination is just two letters, A and T. But the meaning of those words could not be farther from each other. Domination means power up. This is mine to do with as I see fit. Dominion is different. So I thought, okay, these two letters, A and T, if this is too cute, just ignore it. If it's helpful, you can hang on to it. A&T you can think of as anti-taking. Domination involves taking. Dominion is anti-taking. It's more a matter of it having been entrusted to us to care for. So God has entrusted, we hear that in today's reading, God has entrusted all creation to humanity to care for. And that has huge implications for how we handle what God has created. So you hear about how, well, these things are for food for you. Well, they can't be for food for us if we don't care for them in a way that's sustainable. We also care for each other. That's part of the assignment of dominion. How do we care for each other, especially those who have a harder time caring for themselves? All that is within our role as God's image bearers who are given dominion over creation. Now, there's another element that follows these creation stories in Genesis that isn't part of the creed, but it's relevant to us as we look at the creed. And that has to do with the fall. So we've been talking about God's creative intention, God's creative design, but then you read through on the other side of Genesis 2 and 3 and you get the fall, which is more than but includes the disobedience in eating the forbidden fruit. It's kind of downhill from there. And yet, God doesn't revise the assignment. We're still God's image-bearing creatures, still entrusted with dominion for creation. And we experience that now on the other side of the fall. We don't really know what it was like without that. So it's a little complicated. So we're both responsible but free. We're given an assignment, but it's delegated to us. Does this happen in your house ever? You delegate a task to someone, and I'm not going to get in trouble by supposing who that someone might be. And then, you say, well, you didn't do it the right way. All right, well, if the task were really delegated, then there's some risk involved in that, right? God takes risk in delegating to his image-bearing creatures dominion because we might not do it the right way. And in fact, a lot of the time, we don't. We're not really up to the task, but it's a long time to wait for plan B. There's one more element to that, and that is that because we're created, we're finite. So we lack God's ability to see the full implications of what we do or don't do. We just don't have that skill. We're finite. We also, as finite creatures, we don't have the insight to fully understand our motivations. We all have blind spots that are part of our created finitude. So what does this mean? It means that even on our best days, we mess up. And all you have to do is look at recent and all of human history to see what our worst days are capable of bringing forth. Not just messing up, but destruction. Well, thankfully, God does not leave us fully to our own devices. Next Sunday, we'll be looking at the second article of the Creed, which deals with the work and the person of Jesus. And I don't want to read into the Creed, the first article, more than is there and anticipate fully what next week is going to be all about. But we did get into a little bit of the work of Jesus in this creation story that I read from John chapter 1. Did you catch that? John chapter 1, the prologue, could very well be my very favorite passage in the whole Bible. And so it's taking tremendous restraint to only make a couple of observations here. And they're these. In the beginning was the Word. In the beginning was the Word. Jesus was before creation was. Did you catch that? He's the only non-created being ever. The only non-created being ever in the beginning. And then this. All things came into being through Him. Without Him, not one thing came into being. And so, given that all things come into being through Him, so also come into being through Him things like redemption, salvation, deliverance, forgiveness. And so we can hear with John that the light has come into the darkness, and the darkness did not and does not overcome it. And I would suggest that that would be a really, really fine lens for us to look critically at the world and at ourselves. Amen.